General tonight to Seeking Security, Refugee Policy in a Time of Complexity and Change. With our speakers tonight, Associate Professor Harry Minnis and Alex Pagliaro. My name is Tanya Penovich. I'm one of the Deputy Directors of the Caston Centre for Human Rights Law. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. As you can see up there, the Caston Centre will be tweeting this event. So if you're interested in following along on Twitter, all the information is posted up there. Okay, so I'd like to begin by introducing our first speaker, Associate Professor Harry Minnis. He's the Director of the Centre for International Mental Health at the Melbourne School of Population Health at the University of Melbourne. He's also Director of the Victorian Transcultural Psychiatry Unit at St Vincent's Health, Melbourne, and co-director of the WHO Collaborating Centre on Research and Training in Mental Health and Substance Abuse. He was a member, as a lot of you will be aware, of the Immigration Minister's Council on Asylum Seekers and Detention and its predecessors from 2001 to last year. Associate Professor Minnis is a psychiatrist working in three broad areas, and these include mental health system development, particularly in low-resource and post-conflict settings, culture and mental health, with a focus on mental health of immigrant and refugee communities, and the development of services for culturally diverse societies, and the human rights of people with mental illness. Associate Professor Minnis has an intimidating list of honorary positions, including positions with the World Health Organization and Harvard Medical School, and I won't catalogue them to you tonight because they're all online on the Caston Centre event page. Now, tonight, Associate Professor Harry Minnis doesn't propose to speak too much or too directly about the shortcomings of Australia's current approach. He will focus instead on what he thinks Australia should be doing and the conceptual and legal frameworks that guide what we should do. Of course, the contrast between these things and what we are currently doing will be clear. So if you'd like to join with me in thanking Associate Professor Minnis, it would be great.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's very good of you to come on a beautiful Melbourne evening and participate in a discussion about an issue that I'm sure everybody in this room cares about a great deal, and for many of us, if not all, an issue which has exercised us for a good number of years. I'm particularly grateful to the Caston Centre for actually organising an event like this, and feel very honoured to have been asked to participate in the discussion. We have a lot of work to do on this issue of asylum seekers and refugees and how we as a country are going to respond in ways that we can all feel good about and that will be effective for those who are most affected, and that is people who are seeking our protection. Asylum seeker policy, particularly as it relates to boat arrivals, irregular maritime arrivals, has clearly been one of the most contentious and most contested policy arenas in Australian public life over the past couple of decades. Progress has been made in some areas, but then there have also been very serious reversals. After announcing a series of solutions in inverted commas, Federal Labor Government has received and responded to the Houston Panel report, the expert panel report. The outcome of that report and the government's response has included a number of very positive developments. There's been an increase in the humanitarian intake. There's been a renewed commitment to developing a regional framework and a continuing commitment to tackle people smuggling, which is a lucrative trade in desperation and misery. At the same time, the government has introduced a series of harsh measures focused on deterrence that are, in my view, both unnecessary and counterproductive, and go against the spirit of the Houston Panel report and against what I think we as a country would claim that we are seeking to do. For its part, the federal opposition can't be accused of being unclear about what it's going to do. It's going to return wholesale to the Howard era policies, which include offshore processing of claims, temporary protection visas, and the Leader of the Opposition and the Immigration Spokesman just in the past week or so have come back from Sri Lanka, where they've been looking at how they can turn back boats outside of Australian territorial waters. There's an interesting article by a senior naval officer who spoke about the dangers that this represented, both to those who were being turned back and also members of the Australian Navy who were given the task of turning such boats back. Current Australian policy and the policy of the opposition are, in my opinion, and in crucial respects, very deficient. At a time when the international challenge of displaced persons has never been as daunting as it now is, and the need for creative problem solving has never been greater, there is also a great need for political leadership of a high order, and I'll say a little more about that towards the end. Australia and asylum seekers have benefited from such wise leadership in the past. More than 700 refugees have been resettled in Australia over the past 50 years. We continue to be amongst the most generous nations in terms of settlement of refugees on a per capita basis. The resettlement programs that are available to refugees who achieve permanent residency, permanent protection, are also among the best in the world. These achievements are very real. They shouldn't be forgotten, and they're a legacy that should be built on. But building on this legacy will take both hard work and creative thinking. In that spirit, I think we should seek to identify those elements of Australian policy that are not fit for purpose in an increasingly complex and changing world. Along with the complexities and emerging challenges that we will no doubt face in coming decades, there are new opportunities for progress for the world's displaced. Interdependence is forcing a global reassessment of our dominant conceptions of security. And it's on this issue that I want to mostly focus over the next 15 or 20 minutes. What I'd like to talk about is how Australia can make the most of these opportunities to strengthen protection for refugees and other displaced people in our region and globally. Because I think regional solutions are not solutions. Solutions are going to need to be global. What I will discuss is an approach that would build on Australia's capacity for active, creative diplomacy and on our legacy as a nation that offers refugees our welcome. At the heart of this is the shift that's occurring from a narrow focus on state security, what we most commonly refer to here as border security, to a newly developed construct over the past 10 or 15 years or so, the notion of human security. And the shift from a narrow focus to a much broader focus on human security, I think, is one of the things that we need to most think about as we think about where we want to go. Australia's current refugee policy is best understood as the product of more than a decade of political controversy. On some fronts, following the Houston Report, as I've said, and the government's response, there have been some progress. But the government, under political pressure and having been consistently accused of having lost control of our borders, has increasingly prioritised stopping the boats through a policy of deterrence. The government sought to do this through the Afghanistan and Sri Lanka processing freeze, the stillborn East Timor solution, the overturned Malaysian solution, and the resurrected Pacific solution. In 2002, then opposition leader Simon Crean and Shadow Immigration Minister Julia Gillard wrote, "The Pacific solution is not just costly, it's a short-term ad hoc strategy. Does anyone really believe Australia will be detaining asylum seekers on Nauru in 10, 20 or 50 years? Well, we've reached the 10-year mark. Let's see how we can do it 20 and see how we're doing at 50. That statement and Kevin Rudd's famous last words, that the government will not be lurching to the right on the question of asylum seekers, both seem a very long time ago now. Of course, the government hasn't lost control of our borders. Any asylum seeker can tell you that our border protection measures are very robust. Border security is not leaky. Refugee policy that focuses narrowly on border security, however, and it seeks to deter further boat arrivals, that is, to stop the boats, has at its centre what has been referred to as the securitisation of asylum. According to this now dominant view, at least through the main asylum seeker receiving countries, this is now the dominant view of security. What it posits is that asylum seekers are a potential cause of insecurity. In order to pursue such a view and approach, it's necessary to persuade the population that it is we who are threatened by and must be defended against boat arrivals. Jeff Huysmans has said in a book called Migrants as a Security Problem, the security continuum is an institutionalised mode of policymaking that allows the transfer of the security connotations of terrorism, drug traffic and money laundering to the area of migration. He goes on to say, interestingly I think, that the security logic seeps through the boundaries of reason. And I think this has clearly happened in the way that we are thinking about these issues here, that this very narrow security logic has seeped through the boundaries of reason into some sort of a fantasy world. It hardly needs to be said that such an approach stigmatises, marginalises and diminishes the humanity of asylum seekers. When faced by such a threat, our security can then only be assured by protecting our territorial boundaries and state sovereignty. So we repeatedly hear, stop the boats, we'll decide who comes and how they come, and other such slogans that suggest that asylum seekers are a present danger to us. At the same time, as we've taken such a narrow view of security and have thoroughly and systematically vilified those who seek our protection, we've worked with increasing energy on developing a regional framework. This is a good thing, but I'll say a few words more about the likelihood of us achieving such a regional framework. I would suggest that the combination of these two elements in our asylum seeker policy, that is the narrow focus on state security or border security, and the effort to arrive at a functioning regional framework have been so far ineffective and in the future will be self-defeating. For example, the government committed to establishing a regional framework but then excised the whole of the Australian Territory from Australia's migration zone. What message about Australia's commitment to discharging its international obligations does this send to countries that we hope to persuade to be more active partners in such a regional arrangement? In my view, this policy position undercuts good faith negotiations on a regional framework and makes the achievement of a functioning framework extremely unlikely. Imagine for a moment the situation where each country in our region signs on to the Refugee Convention, right? A wonderful outcome, and then promptly excises its territory from its migration zone. Right? What kind of a regional framework would we have? It's worth imagining this situation is not going to happen because countries are not going to sign on. They are not going to sign on either to the convention unless they receive a direct benefit like Nauru, and they're certainly not going to sign on to an Australia-led regional framework while our position is as it is now. A second example, the government expanded the refugee intake but then announced that it would deny work rights to asylum seekers and refugees who'd come as irregular maritime arrivals. Denial of work rights will have predictably negative consequences for the well-being of those who are subject to this policy. Australia will have a significant number of asylum claimants living in the community for the foreseeable future. A large proportion of these claimants, in recent experience the majority, will meet convention criteria for protection. Denying these people the means to live productive and dignified lives in the community will do them long-term harm, will create social problems, and will place additional and avoidable burdens on our health and social welfare systems. These things are facts. I mean, they are undeniable. A further example. The government has committed additional resources to the mental health care of asylum seekers, but continues to put people into difficult conditions such as Nauru and Manus Island. And we already know from previous experience that these conditions cause both severe and long-term harm. Last week's UNHCR report on conditions on Manus Island Assessment Centre reached the unsurprising conclusion that achieving procedures and conditions of treatment consistent with our Refugee Convention obligations on remote Pacific Island locations is a very significant challenge. This is an understatement. It has long been clear that prolonged immigration detention damages mental health. The short-term manifestations of such harms include depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide attempts, and a number of suicides. We'll read about this stuff in the media. The longer-term harms have to do with the erosion of hope, energy, and any sense of a future. And I think those longer-term harms, we are going to be seeing the consequences of well into the next decade. So Australia's refugee policy framework is, in crucial respects, as I've suggested, deficient. At a time when the global post-World War II Refugee Convention is facing increasing challenges. And we should focus on what's happening globally because it has a direct bearing on what happens to us in Australia. More than 700 people cross national boundaries every year. There are some 30 to 40 million unauthorised migrants. Complex emergencies and human rights abuses result in large flows of asylum seekers, mostly into neighbouring low-income countries that have little capacity to receive or to care for them. The countries hosting the largest number of refugees are Pakistan with 1.7 million and Iran with 886 million. 80% of the world's refugees continue to be in developing countries, with the great majority remaining in the region of origin. In 2011, the UK dropped out of the top 10 refugee hosting countries. Ethiopia moved up to the ninth position, a sign of where we are. More than 40 million people ended 2011 as forcibly displaced persons. Among them were over 15 million refugees, over 26 million internally displaced people, and almost a million asylum seekers. Of these people, about 10.5 million refugees and 15.5 million internally displaced persons were receiving the protection or assistance of UNHCR. At the same time, asylum seekers and refugees are increasingly viewed with suspicion and increasingly as a security threat, which can only be met by the further securitisation of asylum. Receiving countries continuously tighten border controls. Policing is increased. Character and security checks become more intrusive and more stringent. So the response is essentially to take a state security approach to this massive global problem of people who are seeking asylum. The constant, though, in this changing world has been the 51 Convention and the 67 Protocol. The global effort to protect refugees and asylum seekers remains centred on these international instruments. And UNHCR seeks to continue to make vital contributions in holding countries to account in relation to their obligations under the Convention, as it has been doing with considerable frequency in terms of Australia's responses to asylum seekers. So the Convention remains indispensable, and I don't want to suggest in what I'm now going on to say that it should somehow be dismantled or displaced. However, there is now a massive global problem of people who are appropriately seeking protection from danger, and many of them don't satisfy the Convention's definition of a refugee. There are internally displaced people, there are those who've left their country because of a form of persecution which is not recognised in the Convention criteria. There are those who fled in the face not of persecution, but for some other no less lethal threat to their security. At the same time, many of those who qualify as refugees have no prospect of resettlement. In 2011, while some 4.3 million people were newly displaced in that year, according to UNHCR, less than 1% of the world's refugees were resettled. 79,800 people found a resettlement place. Faced with these sorts of facts, we should reassess our approach to chart a more acceptable course into the future. In Australia, policies based on deterrence have been predictably self-defeating. Globally, the post-war regime based on the convention is necessary but not sufficient. So what should we do? Should we work to change the politics? During his term of parliament, the politics of asylum have been as poisonous as ever, and from a policy perspective, totally dysfunctional. Australians and their political representatives will need to decide whether we're the sort of country that accepts people who have a right to safe haven from persecution and a right to seek asylum in Australia. If Australia is unwilling, because no one pretends that it's unable, to accept asylum seekers, then what nation should, and how many will? Who has the capacity that we have? So of course we should continue to try to change the politics of asylum in this country. We have the legacy of a better kind of politics to live up to. While we work to change the politics, we also need to focus, though, on what the ethical and practical foundations for a just and effective policy should be. The threats that people around the world face, particularly those in the least developed nations, include not just civil disorder, war and persecution, the old threats, but also environmental catastrophe and conflict over diminishing resources in an emerging period of climate change. While the convention will continue to be necessary, it will on its own prove to be inadequate to these realities. A new global approach will be needed to respond to both the scale and the complexity of demands for protection. The key challenges that Australia and other nations collectively face is to prepare for these possibilities, which are more than possibilities, they are likelihoods. The increasing understanding of the interconnectedness and wide variety of threats and risks to human survival and well-being and to the security of states has led to a shift in thinking about security from a purely state-centric focus to more of a person focus, to the development of the notion, the construct of human security. The connectedness and interdependence of the contemporary world has also created unprecedented opportunities for new thinking and new kinds of action, which don't only depend on the action of states. The agenda for human security is one such opportunity. It's an opportunity that's been enthusiastically embraced by the development community. Agencies such as AusAid and the UK equivalent have taken on this construct of human security and have been putting it into action with increasing effectiveness. It is also, I think, an agenda that can guide our thinking about how best to respond to asylum seekers and refugees, not just to the larger problems of development. The 1994 United Nations Development Programme, the Human Development Report, recognised the threats to security becoming global and called for a new concept of human security. In 2005, the UN General Assembly committed to defining the concept of human security. Late last year, the General Assembly declared that the notion of human security includes, quote, the right of people to live in freedom and dignity, free from poverty and despair. All individuals, in particular vulnerable people, are entitled to freedom from fear and freedom from want, with an equal opportunity to enjoy all their rights and fully develop their human potential. The General Assembly noted that human security does not have to replace state security. It complements ideas of state security. But this represents still a very substantial shift from the security of states to the security of people, regardless of where they are. It recognises that while the state remains the main guarantor of the security of those under its authority, citizens and others, states frequently not only fail their security obligations, they sometimes become the key sources of threat to their own people. That then results in massive movements of people. So human security means protecting fundamental freedoms, protecting people from severe and pervasive threats. It broadens the focus from border security to focus on the lives of people both within and across state borders. The concept of human security is ripe for a time when the challenges we confront, from humanitarian disasters to persistent poverty to transnational violence to environmental degradation, are beyond the ability of any one nation to solve on its own. On what we might call the methodology of human security, the General Assembly noted, human security calls for people-centred, comprehensive, context-specific and prevention-oriented responses that strengthen the protection and empowerment of all people and all communities. For us, this has a direct relevance. It means that asylum seekers and refugees should be critically important partners in devising the policies and programs that might be more defensible ethically and more effective practically. This doesn't happen at all. Australia is a leader, as I've suggested, in applying these principles of human security in our international development assistance programs. We know how to do it, and we do it increasingly effectively. The concept of human security focuses on prevention and recognises that displacement can result from multiple interconnected threats and vulnerabilities. Last year, the Australian Mission to the United Nations endorsed the human security principle in this statement to the General Assembly. We need to ensure our collective actions are not fragmented, that they focus on prevention and that they benefit directly affected populations. The human security concept provides a normative framework to do just this, which is why Australia supports it. Australia should work to advance the human security agenda, but it should include refugees and asylum seekers in this task. The human security agenda should have an influence on Australian policy in at least two ways. The first is in determining what is an ethically defensible and effective policy for responding to those who seek our protection, and the second is to contribute to the development of programs that will limit the need to seek asylum. In relation to asylum seekers who come within our orbit, the very least that we can do is to refrain from creating policies and practices that deprive already vulnerable people of freedom, dignity and hope. Our policies and practices should be tested against the human security principles that we as a nation have explicitly endorsed. Human security also demands collaboration across states, across the public and private sectors, and across disciplines. It also requires that those who are affected should be full partners in making of policies and decisions that will affect them. People must be empowered to act on their own behalf. And this is something that we should remember in relation to asylum seekers and refugees. So if we're to pursue cooperative arrangements with our neighbours, we should not undermine these efforts by measures such as excision of Australia from our own migration zone. These complex problems can only be solved by harnessing a wide array of energy and creativity. As already mentioned, the human security agenda places a high premium on prevention. The UN Trust Fund for Human Security was established in 1999. One of its projects, part delivered by UNHCR, concerned the post-conflict zone of Ituri in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. According to the Trust Fund report, the project managed to restore livelihoods in agriculture and small-scale manufacturing sectors. At the same time, it improved delivery of basic services and worked with community organisations and youth centres to promote peace and coexistence. Among the beneficiaries were refugees. The report concluded, quote, "The project addressed the full range of insecurities faced by the people of Ituri and proposed activities that helped strengthen civic engagement, reinforce state-society relations, and promote collaborative and peaceful activities towards the achievement of a longer-term development, peace and stability." I think this is the future that we are looking to move towards. The agenda for human security can complement the Refugee Convention. As I said before, it's not suggested that it should in any way replace it. So some of the current realities, just to reiterate, less than 1% of refugees were resettled in 2011. The blunt truth is that for most refugees, let alone internally displaced people, the solution will not be resettlement. UNHCR states that voluntary repatriation has benefited the largest number of refugees over the years, and it remains the preferred solution among most of the world's refugees. Most people, not surprisingly, would prefer to go home and to be safe in their own homes. For millions of refugees, it's the only possible solution. This reality makes the task of preventing and ameliorating the insecurity that drives people into long-term displacement and formal asylum seeking absolutely central to the global refugee challenge. Human security, therefore, I think, points the way to a sort of a convention plus approach to international refugee policy. We already have that in a very small way, but the plus component needs to be very substantially strengthened. As the UN Secretary General has stated, human security is not about adding additional layers to the work of the UN. Rather, it's an opportunity to move from a culture of reaction to one of prevention. Former UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Sadako Ogata, who was also co-chair of the Human Security Commission, once warned that human security is a term which carries the risk of meaning all and nothing. But she added that from a refugee perspective, human security could be a useful complement to the legally based concept of refugee protection. Meaningful progress on human security could ameliorate the pressure on displaced people to undertake hazardous journeys through our region with the goal of claiming our protection. In that sense, a focus on human security in source countries and transit countries would complement the work that will be needed to build a regional framework for refugee protection. So in conclusion, when it comes to refugee policy, the challenge of human security is broader and more complex than a narrow focus on border security or state security would admit. But it's a challenge that will have to be faced. On our side, we have the proud legacy of a nation which again and again has offered a generous welcome to refugees and which has made constructive, creative contributions internationally, including to the creation of the Refugee Convention. We can also count on the inherent decency of the vast majority of the Australian people. A telling story is one from Hugh Bunley, South Australia's Lieutenant Governor. He came to Australia as a boat person. In a speech in Old Parliament House in 2011, Mr. Lee recalled the welcome he received in Darwin Harbour. He said, "After many horrific experiences with coast guards in Southeast Asia, we were apprehensive as to what kind of reception we would now receive. We chugged clumsily into the harbour, then heard the approaching buzz of an outboard motor. It's the coast guard again, we thought, and we braced ourselves. While some even said a little prayer. Gradually emerging out of the morning mist, we saw a tinny with two blokes with shorts and singlets in it, sun hats on, white zinc cream on their noses, fishing rods primed and sticking up in the air, and the first beers of the day were in their hands. They waved at us and steered their boat very close to ours, and one of them raised his stubby as if proposing a salute, a toast. 'G'day, mate,' he shouted. 'Welcome to Australia.' I believe that's how most individual Australians would respond when they confront face-to-face an asylum seeker or a refugee. That's not currently reflected in our national policies. When it comes to asylum seekers and refugees, the first task for our political leaders is to be true to this basic decency that the overwhelming majority of Australians would show when confronted by a stranger in need. Beyond that, the challenge for government is to address the real issue of global displacement, not border security, but human security. A regional framework is part of the solution, but so too is addressing the plight of the millions of displaced people for whom our resettlement will never be possible. And a successful regional framework will be impossible to achieve if we are perceived by our neighbours as failing in our obligations to asylum seekers under our protection and as shirking our international obligations while suggesting that they should shoulder theirs. We can do better than we've done over the past couple of decades. As the global challenge of displacement continues to grow large and more complex, we will have to do a lot better. But this will require a quality of leadership that we have not seen for quite some time. Thank you.
you very much, Associate Professor Minnis. I'm sure that many of you will have questions for Associate Professor Minnis, but they will have to wait because we'll have questions at the end. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Alex Pagliaro. Alex is the refugee campaigner for Amnesty International Australia, helping to ensure that the rights of refugees and asylum seekers are protected. She works directly with refugees, as well as generating public awareness about the facts about asylum seeker arrivals through public events, community engagement and social media. And you might have seen Alex's post on the Katzen Centre blog in recent days. Alex has frequently visited Villawood Detention Centre and is in direct contact with asylum seekers in remote detention locations such as Christmas Island, Darwin and Curtin. In November last year, she visited the Nauru Detention Centre with Amnesty's Graham Tom. Alex has previously worked as a refugee caseworker with Amnesty International, where she assisted asylum seekers living in the community and detention centres with their applications for refugee status, particularly through in-depth research into conditions in their countries of origin. Tonight, Alex will be discussing her recent visit to Nauru and what she saw there, as well as what Amnesty has been hearing about the current conditions on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. She will also be talking about the implementation of the no advantage rule or principle or policy or whatever one calls no advantage, both offshore and in Australia, and what the effects of this policy are for individual refugees in Australia, as well as the international refugee system more broadly. Finally, she'll talk about Amnesty's strategy for changing the situation and how individual Australians can help. Could you please join me in welcoming Alex Pagliaro?
Thank you very much, everyone, for having me and the lovely introduction. So I'm going to maybe actually change tack just a little bit because a lot of my content was just stolen. And I'm going to be trouble with going second. And also, as was mentioned, I wrote a post on the Katzen Centre blog, which kind of covered a little bit about what I was going to say. So I kind of stole a bit of my own content. So you can all just read that for more in-depth information. And I actually think the people in this room probably are very well aware of the problem with the current the current policy. You don't actually have to, you only have to have an interest in this issue to find out what is wrong. You only have to read the countless things I and my colleagues at Amnesty have written, the UNHCR has written, many, many journalists who are amazing on this issue have written about what is happening. There should be more, and I wish there was more in many different ways, in many different mediums, but I feel like there's a good chance everyone here is already up to speed and obviously can ask questions if they want more details. So what I'm going to do instead is first to go through the bad news and all the reasons why anyone who is very keen on refugees having their rights respected should be very depressed at the moment, and there's lots to talk about there. But I'm also then going to talk about the good news and the, I guess, why it's important not to give up hope and why there are still many different avenues for change, and why at the same time as, you know, we seem to be going backwards at an incredibly quick rate, there actually are also are positives and opportunities and things moving forward that often we don't talk about, and it's important to. So then, firstly, the bad news. And a lot of that has been covered, but let's just go over it again. So offshore processing has begun, and with it the no-advantage policy that, you know, we still don't really know what that means in practice, and it doesn't make sense to anyone who is a refugee expert because there's no such thing as an average waiting time. You know, it's, well, almost impossible for a country like Australia to try and recreate the situations facing refugees in places like Pakistan or Thailand, and I mean, if we did, I don't know, we can't even go there. Not even the Australian government would go that far. So that's very worrying. And as was mentioned, I have been to Nauru recently, and I'm in close contact with people on Manus Island. And despite having lots of experience in detention centres in Australia, in Christmas Island, and Curtin, and some of the more horrible places in Australia. Nothing really prepared me for what I saw on Nauru, and it was far worse than we predicted beforehand. When we were there, the 400 odd men there had only been there for 2 months and had already deteriorated to the point that we, as non-mental health experts, but we do associate with people who have been in detention for at least 6 to 9 months generally, in terms of their, the stress that they were displaying, the things that they were telling us, their ability to communicate, and just the sort of obvious levels of anxiety, is just so unusual, and does point to the fact that Nauru and the circumstances around Nauru, in terms of the no advantage, in terms of the not knowing how long they'll be there, why they've been selected when all these other people are still in Australia, the concern about their families when they don't know how long they'll be on Nauru, that kind of toxic combination of factors, together with obviously the awful conditions that they're kept in, the humidity, the tents, the kind of gravel sort of pit that they live in, has led to this truly horrendous situation that is really hard to describe, and unfortunately we weren't able to take photos, so is even harder to describe or try and convey, I guess, to people that haven't been there. So we have offshore processing, that's awful, and now we have children on Manus Island, which, just trying to imagine children being in the same situation as on Nauru is really quite emotional for me, I guess. It's very hard to think about. So on top of that, we have bridging visas in the mainland, which everyone has been pushing for a long time and was something that we were doing really well on. Suddenly we had these amazing bridging visa options where people were released out of detention into the community, but obviously now the government has also twisted that positive and taken away work rights, which will have devastating impacts for the asylum seekers who, it's very interesting working with that sort of group who are incredibly relieved to be out of detention and in the community and are really excited about learning English and understanding Australia. And it's really hard to sort of slowly watch that dwindle and then to just not have anything to do each day and start to consider their future and what's going to happen. And there's no real sign that they're going to be processed. We have no idea when that will even start. And I think there's a feeling within the government that, well, they're all under the no advantage rule. They'll be here for a good few years anyway. There's no real hurry to start processing them. So they're just kind of all sitting there in houses around the country, not really having anything to do. So we have that. We have the AVO issue with over 60 individuals in indefinite detention with no real way out, no kind of real commitment by the government to come up with a solution. And so we have children who potentially could, under current rules, be there for the rest of their lives. And there's a very sad little girl in Villawood who has been in detention in Australia so long that she now has a bit of an Australian accent, which is really cute but really heartbreaking at the same time. We have people, we have over 500, nearly 600 people who have been in Australian detention centres for more than 2 years. And a lot of those people, we do not know why they are still there, why they haven't been released on bridging visas. Many of them were under sort of suspicion of criminal activity in terms of riots and stuff like that, but a lot of them have been cleared of that charge. The police have said, no, we don't have any evidence, we don't want to charge them, but for some reason there's still this cloud over them, they're still there, despite been charged, not having no longer any kind of suspicious sort of issues around their behaviour, but they're just in detention and no one really knows why, and no one will tell anyone in the refugee sector anyway exactly why they're still there. We have returns to Sri Lanka and Afghanistan, countries that we have serious concerns about, and slowly we're starting to hear from people that have been returned that they are still in danger and that they are, they're being threatened or that they are concerned about their safety. And it's very hard for us to get that information, obviously, out of a country like Sri Lanka or Afghanistan. But, that is that's incredibly alarming, to say the least, if Australia is returning people to where they could face further persecution. And despite the advice often of organisations like Amnesty. And now we have this new screening out process where people aren't even given a chance to have their claims heard. They're given a very short interview on arrival where they're asked, well, again, there's a lot of confidentiality and secrecy surrounding these processes, but there are some very simple questions about why they came to Australia, and if they don't give the right answers to those questions, they're turned around and sent home. And, you know, we know that seeking asylum is very complex. Reasons for seeking asylum can be very, very nuanced, and lawyers spend hours with clients trying to understand exactly what their claim is and how exactly the details around why they have fled. And sometimes, sure, people are not actually refugees and should be returned home in safety, but a country like Australia needs to go through that process and find out whether or not you're going to return someone home, you know, to be tortured or killed when they're returned home. That should be pretty basic. So that's, I guess, the bad news. And also, as I said, there's the implications on individuals, and then also the implications on the rest of the region and the rest of the world. Because, to put it just very quickly, not to go into much detail, if Australia isn't willing to live up to its convention obligations, when it's a wealthy, pretty stable country with the resources to do so and the systems in place to do so and a history of doing so, then why on earth would a country like Pakistan or Thailand or Tanzania, who are inundated with so many more refugees, as well as their own, you know, complex human rights issues and economic issues and all the rest of it, why should they do any better than us? And what possible incentives can countries like Australia have, can countries like those have, to do more when a country like Australia is doing so little and doing less and less and less, as are many other Western countries around the world, sadly. So that's very, very depressing, as is the political reality in our country. I guess, you know, the one thing both major parties in Australia seem to agree on is that we need to be tougher and tougher on asylum seekers, especially those arriving by boat. And, you know, we're in election year, we know that it's not likely to get that much better anytime soon. Flowing on from all those things are our public attitudes in Australia and the general public consensus around asylum seekers and refugees, especially those arriving by boat. You know, it feels like our policies have gotten so extreme on this issue, and more things that would a while ago have been unthinkable are now just kind of the way we deal with this process. And more we're just accepting kind of awful policies because they're actually not as bad as the really, really awful policies. And so it kind of feels like everyone's slowly being shifted to the right. And it's sometimes a relief for me to speak to my international colleagues and tell them what's happening in Australia, because at least, you know, they're shocked and, like, kind of, you know, you can hear their jaws dropping to the ground, and that kind of reaffirms the fact that, yeah, it is awful. It's not just me. I'm not alone in my little Amnesty office just thinking it's horrible. Anyone around the world who works on these issues is, even, you know, those things are, you know, they're not perfect in Europe and America, in many other countries, they still are just gobsmacked by how far in Australia politicians are kind of allowed to go on these issues. And I think at the moment we are facing a particularly difficult issue with the messaging around this, people who want to see people arriving by boat treated fairly and with their rights respected, I think have come under attack and have struggled to fight against the "but we have to stop people from losing their lives at sea" argument. And in our reading of the different polling that's been done around this issue and sort of where public attitudes are, we estimate that, I mean, we lost 20-30% of the population around that issue. I think that's to do with wanting a humane, these are people that want a humane solution, but are convinced that that offshore processing is acceptable if it stops people drowning at sea, that we have to be cruel to be kind. And I think part of that as well is just the desire to stop talking about it and thinking about it. I think Australians are actually sick of feeling bad about this issue, you know, hearing politicians talk about this issue, reading about this issue, seeing images about this issue in the media, and just want it to go away. And I think offshore processing, they hoped, was a magical solution that would make this issue go away. It was okay for politicians to assure them that this is actually the nicest thing to do because at least we'll stop people drowning at sea. And that tied everything up in a nice package, and we tried to move on. So that's all very, very, very depressing. And I feel a little bit shaky just reading it all out in one sort of ball of awfulness. But there is good news, and I think some of that good news has been covered. I think the first thing is that there are so many policy opportunities around this issue because everything has been done so badly at the moment that there's a lot of room to improve. There are both, obviously nationally, but especially internationally, there are amazing opportunities throughout the Asia-Pacific region to improve refugee protection and, you know, decrease the reasons why people get on boats in the first place. I mean, just for example, in Pakistan, I mean, I can't remember the exact numbers now off the top of my head, but less than 200 people were resettled from Pakistan last year. And that's, you know, the country with the, I think, second biggest population of refugees in the world, many of whom do want to come to Australia. So without resettlement as even an option in Pakistan, well then obviously, you know, what's the point of waiting there for the supposed queue? There are opportunities in Malaysia and in Thailand, and these are countries that obviously do not want to do, you know, to improve refugee protection to help the Australian government, but these are countries that are slowly starting to see, very slowly, admittedly, but slowly starting to see that increasing refugee protection, and again, I think this comes into the human security argument, that increasing that in their countries, for their populations, as well as the big refugees' populations in their countries, ultimately does help their domestic stability and their economy, and those arguments are being made, and more when I speak to NGOs across the Asia Pacific who work on these issues, who just work in amazingly difficult circumstances with very limited resources and often very aggressive, and governments that just don't really think about civil society in the way that Australia does. They all say that they are increasingly having winning arguments and getting policy wins and changing kind of funding priorities and all these amazing things through arguing sort of with the government that it's in their interest too. Because at the end of the day it is, and I think sometimes the human rights community forgets that that's the reason why human rights is an excellent concept, is that ultimately it is better for everyone. If the more human rights that everyone has, the more human rights that everyone else has. I'm not sure whether that's the best way to put it. But as we improve human rights around the world, it all kind of should improve together. Otherwise, we see situations in Australia where we just try and kind of take away people's human rights in order to meet the lowest standards as opposed to the other way around. And part of the reason why there are these opportunities is because we have such a robust international framework. And we are very lucky, I think, in the refugee field that the Refugee Convention is still such a robust convention that still works and still meets the needs of, in the best possible way. Obviously, there are massive challenges, but it is an international framework that has, you know, I think stood the test of time. And, you know, with the additions and with continual comments by the UNHCR and updating it and improving it and making it meet modern times and the changing refugee situation around the world, it has, I think, provided an amazing tool for that, given the extreme challenges that the refugee community faces around the world with, you know, 43 million displaced people. And where it gets even more positive, I guess, is that in many ways the protection-focused policies, you know, in Malaysia, in Pakistan, in Thailand, and around the rest of the world, actually meet the domestic kind of goals of the Australian community in a way that our purely domestic focus so far simply cannot and will not in the future. You know, the stopping the boats is an awful phrase that has, you know, corrupted, I guess, the discourse in this country on refugees. But at the end of the day, obviously everybody wants the boats to stop. There's no one I hope, in Australia, who wants to see people risking their lives on very dangerous journeys to Australia by boat. But the reality is at the moment is that there are no other choices, or very limited other choices. And so inevitably some people are going to decide, given their, you know, three or four equally awful choices before them, to make that boat journey to Australia. And so if the Australian government is seriously committed to, you know, regional protection, as it keeps saying, it would, for example, not be spending, I don't know, $4 billion plus on Nauru and Manus Island, while at the same time only spending $10 million on regional protection initiatives. I mean, I think that sort of financial kind of balancing out is a pretty good, you know, first step in readjusting our priorities and readjusting our policy to where it will actually have impact, as opposed to just political announcement after political announcement. But as I'm sure, again, you're all aware, the problem is that most Australians don't sort of see that, because most Australians don't know that, and they don't know that because it takes more than kind of, you know, a quick pithy soundbite like stop the boats to say that and to explain it. And that, I guess, is a challenge. And the only way that I believe, and Amnesty International believes, that this policy will change in the long run in Australia, and that this kind of the conversation in Australia will change, is if more and more people have the opportunity to actually engage in a different conversation. And I think all too often the people that do care about refugee rights and the people that do try and do things, we all talk to each other about these issues, and we consistently reaffirm our own beliefs and maybe expand our own beliefs and find out more about our own beliefs, but really it's very hard to go that next step and actually talk to someone who hasn't already had a chance, I guess, or more than one chance to engage in a sort of a different conversation on these issues. And I think, again, as Terry said, most people have never met a refugee, and chances are, and I mean, Amnesty's done research on this, and we have had lots of experience on campaigning on this, and definitely both our research and our experience does add up to the fact that if Australians are given the chance to engage in this issue in a positive way, if they're given a chance to actually talk to a refugee or at least hear a refugee's story, then that goes a long way to changing the way that people look at this issue. And I suppose that's, for us, the strategy. Obviously that's easy to say, but that takes a long time is the problem with that strategy. We are never going to have the resources that, I guess, governments have in being able to get mass media coverage. We're never going to be able to reach as many people as quickly as they can. But, I mean, Amnesty has, I think, 200,000-odd supporters in Australia, and what we've been doing over the past couple of years is slowly training more and more of those supporters and feeding facts and information into more and more of those supporters and encouraging them to go and, I guess, work in their communities and push that out in their communities. And it's a very slow and painful slog, and we have amazing activists who do a lot of amazing things, but up against a lot. But that is a challenge that Amnesty has, I guess, taken on and is continuing to work on. And in a very strange way, we are seeing amazing sort of gains in sort of small kind of discrete areas at the same time as the whole picture, the overall picture seems to be collapsing. And I think that's where we need to focus our energy on, is pushing those areas where we are seeing change and better, you know, little towns or communities or suburbs where slowly people are changing their neighbours and their colleagues and everyone at their local school, and capitalising that on building more of a actual kind of, I guess, movement of people who are willing to talk to other Australians about this issue and push that out. And, I mean, Amnesty International was built on the idea that very small acts by ordinary people otherwise just going about their daily business can actually change the world. And that is something that we have seen work over and over and over again, and is something that has never happened fast and has never happened easily, and does take a lot of work, but it is something that works. So I guess that's our challenge in an election year when, I mean, in a way, we have to just give up on politicians, is really focusing our energy on the Australian people, and we know that there will be so much outrage at the same time as these awful policy announcements are going on. There will be more and more people actually saying, you know what, I don't want kids to be on Manus Island, and that just doesn't fit right with me, and looking at their children being like, I wouldn't want them there, I don't agree with this policy anymore. And so that is the trickle effect, and the sort of, or the ripple effect that we hope to create this year and in coming years, because that's the reality, is that it's a long road ahead to change all these awful policies, and to get to a place where our politicians are willing to listen. So I would encourage you all to join Amnesty, or even if you don't join Amnesty, because that's not even the important bit, but to sit down and think about in your life how you can actually have a conversation with someone who doesn't agree at the moment or is uncertain, and how you can find out the information that they need to change their mind, or you can go and speak at your local school, or do a myriad of things that will actually help this issue, even though they might feel small. So yeah, that is all I have to say.
Okay, we have a little bit of time for questions, so there's a roving microphone that will be coming around. We'll try to limit the number of questions, because otherwise we will blow out a bit with time. But does anyone have a question for either of our speakers? We might start there.
Hi, I'm Lydia from Labour for Refugees, and I'd like to take up the issue that Alex and Yaron have made about the importance of public education campaigns in terms of shifting public opinion. And given that both major political parties have lost their way and are not showing leadership and vision in this area, clearly the onus is on all activists and the community-minded people who believe in human rights to educate each other's neighbours and friends and relations and people in schools, etc. How do you think Amnesty could work more successfully with other advocacy organisations like RAC and RAN and a whole host of other community-based organisations to shift public opinion, because that's the only thing that will actually make the major political parties shift their policies, their draconian policies in regard to offshore processing and the punitive policy of deterrence that is currently supported.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think the refugee sector and the human rights advocacy sector can definitely do a lot more in terms of working in collaboration, and I think that does come down to being more aware about the fact that we are very outdone by politicians and by the media in terms of how much voice we really have in the community. And so we do need to make sure that we work together a lot more in terms of to magnify the message that we have. I guess the first step to that is always agreeing on a message, which is often a problem, because even though essentially we're all saying the same thing, you know, with organisations, that, you know, suddenly you start arguing about the nuances of what they're saying. But definitely, I think in the last 6 months, and falling with slow process, but the urgency and the of the issue and the fact that things have gotten so much worse, I think has forced everyone to work together a lot more. And there's now lots of working groups. Although I have to say that, because I do think that nothing ever comes out of a working group, but there are different forums and conversations happening at the moment to try and push that forward in a more coordinated way. So it's definitely something Amnesty is really committed to, but but admittedly have struggled in actually making a reality over the past few years.
Okay, we have a question here.
My name's Annette Brennan, and I seem to remember reading a few years ago in that children weren't going to be kept in detention. Would you be able to comment on how that changed and why now we've got people like your little girl with an Australian accent? Because I don't remember hearing any policy change on that.
That is still the policy, that children will not be in DeNova. How they differentiated that is that children, so the policy was always children will not be in detention centres. So technically, at the moment, there are no children in detention centres, they are in detention facilities. So it's really an awful semantic. So they are in what they call immigration in Villawood, the immigration residential housing area, and they're in what loosely a whole lot of different places called APODs, alternative places of detention, which are very, very similar to detention centres. Not as bad, not as high fences, but still fences, not as many cameras, but there are still cameras, still security guards, all the rest of it. I think that fiction has even deteriorated further recently because of overcrowding. They've just changed the names of different parts of detention centres or different facilities where one day it's a detention centre, the next day suddenly it's a detention facility or an RNA pod. My colleagues and I have had these kind of hilarious conversations in the office about some immigration bureaucrat just picking up a piece of paper and stamping it, and suddenly it's no longer a detention centre and you can put children there. That's all.
It's all false.
Thank you.
Can we have a question in the front?
Thank you very much, Professor Minister and Alex. My name is Hashim Matolpani from Monash Asia Institute. I'd like to dwell with this subject from the history aspect of it. Second World War, both loads of people coming into Australia as refugees, asylum seekers, and so on. And then the war in Asia didn't affect so much, so many refugees. Then we had the war in Vietnam. When the United States withdrew from the war, there were thousands of Vietnamese coming this way. And then the war in the Middle East going on, the same thing, numbers of people coming in. My question is, how could we stop refugees from coming in, if it is possible? Because those people who came from England were paid £10 each to come and settle here. My former job was, back in 73, I was working with the Department of Immigration, so I had a first-hand experience of dealing with the refugees. My job was to be the interpreter for the Papua New Guinea fighting for their independence in those days, and we interviewed about 20 of them. We were based in Moiku Island, north of York Peninsula. Now, the problem with insisting repeated time again, many of them came here, settled, did extremely well. Thank you for that. Others didn't do too good and continue. So, I believe that war is the cause of all the trouble that we have. Do you agree with me?
Big question to deal with quickly.
The first thing for song, war, what is it good for? One of the points that I was trying to make, absolutely, war is the main cause. But the nature of, as we know, the nature of war has changed. Much conflict is internal. The main are not combatants, and so on. So even the nature of that kind of armed conflict has changed very substantially. But I think what we're looking towards in the next several decades is many other reasons that people will have just as much reason to flee. And there are several things. The most dramatic is if the current efforts on ameliorating the impact of global warming to climate change, if it continues at the current rate, the population movements that we will see will absolutely dwarf anything that we have ever seen before. And the threats to which people will be subjected and dangers will be no less than people who find themselves in a situation of armed conflict. We need to be thinking ahead. and to say, you know, the Refugee Convention absolutely is essential. It's in a sense all we have. And it needs to be protected. It needs to be fiercely protected. But it's not enough. And if we go along the trajectory we're going now, it will increasingly be not enough. It will increasingly refer to only a very small proportion of people who should have the right to seek asylum because of the peril they face. So, yeah, war will continue, obviously, to be a big issue. You know, we've got charming things happening in different parts of the world that will continue to ensure that armed conflicts will continue. The other point is that the number of people that we settle is so small that even with a well-functioning convention,
it only deals with the problem of fear. Okay, I might just, we've got a questioner here, and I think we'll only have room for time for one more after that, so fire away and maybe keep it brief.
Given that current law and policy is based on the concept of deterrence, I was wondering whether there's any empirical evidence to point to any that works for asylum seekers that they can be deterred. If there is any, why that hasn't come to the fore in policy making?
All you need to do is to look at the rises and falls in the number of boat arrivals over the past decade and a half. Look at where different sorts of policies were introduced, implemented, and all the rest of it. And the evidence that efforts at deterrence are effective is pretty slim. If it exists, we had very harsh policies around the lawn, but that didn't stop people coming. I think what people really are a bit dumb. You know, they kind of forget that the circumstances that refugees are fleeing. Now, and Alex referred to this before, you know, if we want to go down that track, let's make it even worse. That will deter people. Is that what we want to do? I think so. So, you know, the notion of deterrence is a fiction, in my view.
Yeah, around the world, and the conclusion was to very little to none. That's make it much worse than that.
I think we should focus not so much on whether, you know, deterrence is effective, but whether there is political advantage in creating a climate of fear and suspicion. Mm-hmm. Now, the evidence for that is strong.
We have one last question, just over on that side.
I was wondering if Harry could talk briefly about the circumstances of his resignation. The following thing, Alex, you mentioned that the Nauru and Manitoba cost 4 million.
There's not much to be said about my resignation from the council. I've been on council and predecessor bodies for about 11 years. I'm not very smart, I'm a bit slow. Eventually, even I understood that things were heading in an appalling direction, and that there was actually no possibility of having any impact on the direction that was being taken. And in those circumstances, I think, you know, when you're a ministerially appointed advisor, the only reasonable course you can take is to say, well, I can no longer be of any use to you. You know, your views and mine have diverged to such a point that it's no longer honest for me to be a member of this council.
So in terms of where that figure came from, the set of estimates last year, it was a DIAC briefing page that the government was released that said that Nauru would cost $2 billion to set up and run, but to set up a bit of and run for 4 years, and that had that costing had a lot of exclusions to it. It said this figure was not included, this figure, there was a whole long list. And so we've just taken that figure and doubled it for Madison. And it seems a little bit, $4 billion, probably a lot more because generally the estimates are very low. But we'll get more updates because we've been at it this year and it's going to be able to share them.
Okay, I'm going to be quick. And before I thank our speakers tonight, I'd like to thank you all for coming, and I find it really heartening that there is such interest in this issue, and the fact that this is being recorded may result in further dissemination of this information. I was in Canberra a couple of weeks ago at the Senate committee hearing on the bill that seeks to effectively excise the Australian mainland from the migration zone. And not only was I struck by a sense of deja vu and incredulity, but it was striking that there were a mere 36 submissions made to that Senate inquiry when 6.5 years earlier, the almost identical bill, slightly less harsh bill, proposed by the Howard government, spawned in the Senate inquiry 136 submissions, all of which were vehemently opposed to the passage of the bill, bar one, which was the Immigration Department. So it was quite depressing that there were 100 fewer submissions, and it was a point that I made vociferously a couple of weeks ago. So I'm very heartened by your presence, and thank you all very much for coming. And thank you to our two speakers, to Associate Professor Minnis and to Alex Pagliaro. I think it's been a really informative session. Thank you.